You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. The king of Thailand having some girlfriend problems. We've all heard the Jay-Z song, 99 Problems. Well, it appears the king of Thailand has 100 problems. The Los Angeles Times' Shasik Bengali has the story. The Thai king's companion vanished after upsetting the queen. Now she's back in the spotlight. So the king of Thailand has this 35-year-old girlfriend, and she's actually got a title in the government. She is Thailand's royal noble consort, a title given to a companion of the king who is not his wife. She's the first person to be named to that position in literally a century. And there are some academics in Thailand who suggest this is strategic. This is a way for the monarchy and the king to bridge the gap that exists between themselves and the people. And there is a good deal of resentment in Thailand over the monarchy. And so you've got this good-looking 35-year-old former army nurse who was raised in the northern Thai countryside, and she's been out helping the people with the challenges that they've been dealing with following a number of natural disasters in Thailand. And it was just last year that the royal noble consort disappeared. And there was a statement put out by the Royal Gazette reproaching her for misbehavior and disloyalty and trying to outshine the queen and causing discord in the palace. Well, now she's back. She's active. And we'll see how the king is able to balance the queen, the consort, and the people in Thailand. The Apprenticeship Act is up for a vote in the House of Representatives today. I support apprenticeship. I support internships, career technical education, but I just can't vote for this bill. I don't understand why our 50 states are not in a better position to meet the needs of their economies than the federal government. The federal government should abolish the Department of Education. Education isn't a federal function. It's a function best left to the states and the people. And of course, in Colorado, in Florida, in Arizona, New Jersey, and New York, the state legislators know best what skills are needed to impart on young people to ensure that there's greater competitiveness in the global marketplace. More and more, our education decisions are made in Washington, D.C., and funds are withheld if states don't comply. I don't want to see career technical education go that way. I want to see our states innovate and tinker and try with different strategies to try to impart skills on young people that will ensure their success, their higher wages, their greater opportunities for career development. So I'll be voting no on the Apprenticeship Act today, not because I don't support career technical education, but because I believe that Washington might ruin it, and our states are in the best position to advance it. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez believes that the way to deal with the virus is to pay people to stay home. I know this because she tweeted it. Quote, "To get the virus under control, we need to pay people to stay home." You see, this is part of a broader theme that I expect you might see from Democrats in the coming months. They're going to use the coronavirus to try to execute on the broader goals of socialism. And if coronavirus can be a veneer to redistribute wealth in this country, they're here for it. You see, I think that the best answer to coronavirus is not a stimulus bill. It's not the printing of more money. It's allowing people to work. It's giving people the confidence of reliable testing. It's ensuring that we have the proper sanitation in place. But it's not shutting down America and making our fellow Americans reliant on government. You see, the goal of socialists is always to make people reliant on the largesse of government, but eventually that requires the extraction of resources of other people without their consent. That can disincentivize productivity and really the nature of America. Look, the reason we have the edge on the world is because we're the most competitive, the most innovative, the most ambitious. And if we do as AOC suggests and just pay people to stay at home, we'll lose that. We won't be America anymore. That's why I'm not going to support a universal basic income under coronavirus. I'm not going to support endless payments to people. But I do believe we should open up. I do believe we should allow people to go to work. And I would invite Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez to join me in that advocacy. Today, the House Armed Services Committee held hearings on the administration's planned drawdown of troops in Afghanistan, hopefully a total withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. And on the Armed Services Committee, you typically have a lot of folks who are in favor of wars because a lot of the donations that come to members of the Armed Services Committee for political campaigns are given by defense contractors. So it often is a very pro-war committee, and I found myself at odds with many members of the committee on both sides of the aisle because I believe America is at her best when she has a focused foreign policy, not an adventurous foreign policy for the benefit of those who financially get to access untold sums of slush fund cash during these overseas operations. Here's the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, with his opening statement.
As mentioned, this is an incredibly important and very timely topic. It's just about 19 years ago that we went into Afghanistan, and at the time, we had a very clear mission, having just been attacked on 9/11 by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. We went in there to make sure it never happened again, to stop the threat and to contain it. And I think that continues to be the top mission. We face a threat from transnational terrorist groups. We can debate how large that threat is, where exactly it comes from, and how best to contain it, but it is not debatable that that threat is there. It's also worth noting that for all the problems and troubles and difficulties that we had, that mission has been successful in one sense. We have not had a transnational terrorist attack on the U.S. And when we think about all the men and women who served in the military, those who lost their lives, those who were injured, those who have suffered because of this, also all of the State Department personnel and all of the aid workers who have been there, and all of our allies and partners. Keep in mind, this is not just the United States of America. NATO and a number of other countries have participated in this mission. And in that one key point, it has been successful, and it should not be taken for granted. But the question is, where do we go from here? Because while that has been successful, there has also been a great cost, as was just mentioned, in terms of lives lost, people injured, and the sheer cost to the nation in money as well. So where do we go from here, and how do we move forward? I think it's important that we continue to maintain the mission to stop transnational terrorist threats.
I took a different position than many. Here was my contribution to the debate.
Not only am I a minority member of this committee, I hold a minority view on the war in Afghanistan on the committee. I'm against it. Based on even the words of our own witnesses today, the corruption in Afghanistan is unsolvable. The war is unwinnable, and the strategy is indecipherable. It's not a criticism of the current administration. These are conditions that have been present for the last 19 years as we've traded the same villages back and forth with the Taliban. I listened intently as Dr. Biddle said, well, we're leaving and we're getting nothing. What we're getting is out. To me, the biggest loser in Afghanistan is the nation that stays the longest. Now, as I read some of the prepared testimony of our witnesses, particularly Dr. Biddle, here's how the argument seems to go. 2,500 troops really has no military value. There is no technical capability with 2,500 troops that we have that is going to fundamentally win this war. We've had 100,000 troops there and we couldn't win it. And now we think with 2,500, that's what's going to like preserve these alliances and ensure our allies that we're really there with sufficient grit. But that the purpose of these 2,500 troops is politics, that it is a political feature of the war in Afghanistan, that if we leave 2,500 troops there, we will get more leverage. And that if we engage in accelerated drawdowns, well, the Afghans, the Taliban in particular, will see that this is sort of a war of attrition that the United States is going to lose. And so they're just going to stick there and maintain a level of violence that allows them to potentially recapture their political power. But the obvious question is, if we know that the 2,500 troops we're leaving there don't have military value and are there as a political statement, probably the enemy knows that too. Probably they understand the very dynamics that our witnesses have laid out through their testimony today, that this only ends one way, with us leaving, with the Taliban getting more power, and with conditions in Afghanistan in pretty rough shape going forward, as they have been for the last two decades, as they were for a substantial period of time before that. I'm grateful that in the Trump administration, we have highlighted our near-peer adversaries as the requisite focus for our work. I'm glad that we don't believe we have to chase every potential terrorist into every potential cave in Wherever-istan so that we can, you know, thump our chests and say that we're being tough with a global counterterrorism mission. It is my sincere hope that we not only reduce our troop levels to 2,500, but that we reduce them to zero, that we leave Afghanistan. This has been the longest war in our nation's history. Our country is weary of it, even if the Armed Services Committee is not. And I yield back.
Disobedience in California. No, I'm not talking about Gavin Newsom disobeying his own orders for lockdowns. That was heavily covered in the media. It's the news that Orange County, Sacramento, and El Dorado County sheriffs will not enforce Gavin Newsom's curfew order. We get the story from thegatewaypundit.com's Christina Layla. California Governor Gavin Newsom on Thursday issued a curfew for most California counties. The curfew will affect 41 out of 58 counties in California, currently in the most restrictive quote-unquote purple tier. Earlier this week, Newsom said he was looking at studies from other countries on curfews, including France and Saudi Arabia. Let's hope that Gavin Newsom isn't picking up a whole lot of other policy ideas from Saudi Arabia. And when you look at France, they're only allowing their citizens out of the house for like an hour a day. You get your 1 hour to go and do any grocery shopping or any other errands you have or do any sort of exercise, and then you've got to be back in your house. So let's hope that there's not a continuing trend to import those policies from Europe to our country. And the hypocrisy here is just so palpable, like that Gavin Newsom would go and violate his own orders and then become even more restrictive. So these particular sheriffs in these particular counties are not going to enforce the curfews, instead embracing more freedom for their citizens. We stand with the sheriffs. FloridaPolitics.com's A.G. Gankarski reports that I'm here for the Donald Trump 2024 campaign. And it's true. There is no Republican who could summon the populism and the energy and the enthusiasm that we saw as a consequence of President Trump's campaign. Look, I was there in the final weeks. President Trump is all about the enthusiasm of our country, rising wages, economic nationalism, putting our people first, ending these forever wars, canceling trade deals that put our people last, and ending the policies that make our border a joke, ensuring that if people have to make a claim for asylum, that they can do it in their own country, not ours, as a consequence of catch and release. I just see the way the American people react to President Trump, and there is not a Republican politician on the scene who in 2024 could really summon this populist enthusiasm the way that Donald Trump does. So if he's running in 2024, I'm with him, and I'm pretty sure you will be too. I joined Steve Bannon on the War Room Pandemic podcast. We discussed how our nation should respond to coronavirus. We discussed the election and the future of the Republican Party. Here are a few of the highlights.
If we do not fix this, if we do not expose this fraud, They're not going to get worse at it. They're going to get better at it. And we will never win another national election again. Those are the stakes in these fights in the several states that you've discussed. And I don't think that, like, to really get a full audit across the enterprise, we have to flip every one of these states at once. Here's my prediction, Steve. We flip one of these states that the media has called for Joe Biden, and the whole veneer comes down. The whole fiction that he's president-elect Joe Biden and that this thing is over is eroded if you're able to see that there was fraud sufficient to flip a state. Because then I think the American people will say, well, wait a second. Like, if you lied to us about Georgia, we got to ask some more questions about Wisconsin. Or if you lied to us about Wayne County, Michigan, how are we supposed to believe what went on in Fulton County? Right. And I think that asking those tough questions is an important obligation the president has, not for his own political fortunes, but for the future of a populist movement that is very much opposed by the people who run these places where they're more susceptible to fraud. Biden's acting like he's reaching across the aisle for Republicans, but he's reaching in all the wrong places. I mean, he wants to import the foreign policy of Dick Cheney and the trade policy of Paul Ryan, you know, and in his
well,
own
globalist.
Mind.
That's all globalism.
Well, right. But like that, when you talk about the future of our movement,
yeah,
you know, I don't believe that it is going to be easy for us to even maintain the Republican mantle if you see some of these establishment figures kind of, you know, migrate to a Biden world. China is not our friend. Joe Biden holds this view that if we just bring China closer to us, that they will be more like us. But the reality is when we bring China closer, it makes us more vulnerable. And the Chimerica dream that we've been sold by both parties has really become a nightmare for our people.
Thanks for listening to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Make sure you subscribe, give us a 5-star rating, leave us a comment to let us know what you think of the show. Have a great weekend. Join us next Monday for more Hot Takes.